Two men are standing in front of the fire. One has long hair and a beard that tangles down his chest. He's wearing a cloak with suns and moons on it, and he's leaning on the handle of a huge sword. The other man is short, cross-eyed, a bit mental-looking. He has one hand tucked inside his leather jacket.
"I went out to the hazel wood,"
the tall man with the beard says,
"because a fire was in me head."
"All right."
Mark and the others arrive at the bonfire.
"Never better,"
the man says.
"I see you've brought some friends along."
He tips his head at Carl and Barry.
"They're just two young lads have been helping us out,"
Mark says.
"They wanted to come along."
"Why not? Why not?"
The druid nods along.
"The more the merrier. Do come warm yourselves."
He waves his hand and they step towards the fire. And then there is a flash. A flash of air, not the kind you can see. Now the druid's sword is stretched out, with the point pressed into Dino's throat. For a moment, nobody moves. Like the whole world is balanced on the tip of the sword. Then the cross-eyed man leans in and whips the sports bag out of Dino's hand.
"We'll take care of this for now,"
the druid says. The cross-eyed man pulls the shotgun out of the bag, splits it open over his knee, and rattles out the shells. The druid lowers the sword. Dino sags like he's deflating.
"Now, friends,"
the druid says,
"business before pleasure. Let us adjourn to my office."
He turns and walks up the hill. They follow after him, with the cross-eyed man behind. No one has said a word since the druid swung his sword. Fear crackles in the clouds, in the long grass. The lights of the city rise up around, like they have come to watch something happen. And now a shape appears at the top of the hill, a rocky black shape that stares out like a skull.
"Which of you scholars can tell me what this is?"
the druid says cheerfully. None of them says anything, and then Barry says in a voice like he's hypnotized,
"A dolmen."
"Very good."
The druid is pleased.
"One of the oldest forms of burial chamber, also known as a portal tomb, as it is a doorway to the land of death. Note the distinctive tripartite structure for the three aspects of the goddess."
He looks from one face to the next.
"In ancient times it is here that offerings were left for the unseen ones."
Nothing happens for a moment. Then Mark jerks to life. He takes the package from under his belt and holds it out to the druid. But the cross-eyed man grabs it instead. He rips open the paper and counts the money, muttering. The druid leans on his sword and watches him with a little smile, like someone watching children playing. When he has finished, the cross-eyed man lifts his head. He nods to the druid. The druid walks up to the dolmen and stretches his arm into the dark between the ground rocks and the slab lying across them. His hand comes out, holding a bag. He throws it to Mark. Mark opens it. Inside are smaller bags of white powder, other bags of pills, a brick of hash in cling film. It's just like on TV.
"All to your satisfaction?"
the druid says.
"Yeah, brilliant,"
Mark says.
"Thanks very much."
He looks at Noxer, at Stee. Stee jerks his head in the direction of the car.
"Well,"
Mark says. The druid has his head tilted back, looking up at the sky.
"But you're not leaving already."
"Let's go, let's go, let's go," Carl is thinking. They are all thinking. Mark too, but he doesn't know what to do.
"Come,"
the druid says.
"It is so rare that we see our friends. Let us sit by the fire."
At the bottom of the hill, the bonfire has burned low. The cross-eyed man picks up a jerry can and pours petrol on it. Flames jump out. The druid laughs.
"Sit. Sit,"
he says, laughing. They sit in a ring around it, like children. Stee is trying to make Mark look at him, but he won't. The druid takes a pipe from his cloak and lights it and passes it around. In the firelight you can see he is not that old. He is less old than Carl's dad.
Once this whole country was a stronghold of the goddess,
he says.
Magical sights lie all around here. The modern jackals do not see it, of course. They'd conquer over this very hill if you gave them half a chance. But to anyone with ears...
He pulls his shoulders in. The sword lies on the ground beside him, pointing into the fire like a gold tongue drinking.
You can hear them. The dead.
Carl gets the pipe. The smoke tastes weird. Maybe it's because they're out here in the fields and trees. He is trying not to hear the dead. He is trying not to think of the black space between the rocks of the dolmen where the druid put his hand.
Hence my little enterprise,
the druid says.
I was chosen by the goddess to protect this hill from the defilers.
So how old would you say it is then?
Mark says, because the druid is staring at him.
Like the dolmen.
The druid goes quiet, like he's thinking back to when he built it.
Perhaps 3,000 years.
Beside Carl, Dino bursts into giggles. He tries to stop, but they just get worse. He laughs and laughs. High Hyena yelps till he's on his side. Then when he can speak, he says...
Sorry, just reminded me of this cunt. Wanted to ride a fucking skeleton.
He explodes into giggles again. The druid stares at Dino without smiling.
It's just a game we're playing on the way up here,
Mark explains.
If you could pick one woman, you know, to be with. Steve picked Helen of Troy.
Helen of fucking Troy! Oh,
gasps Dino.
The dozy prick.
Steve looks even more pissed off, like he's just about keeping himself from saying something. The druid just stares.
Helen of Troy,
he says. Barry hands Carl the pipe again. His eyes are like the black skies of a lost place. But above his head, the stars are like millions of eyes. Carl pretends he doesn't feel them watching. He looks into the fire instead. Question. But in the fire, there are hands reaching up trying to get out. Answer. Don't look in the fire either. He sucks on the pipe, trying to build up the wall of fog that hides him from the dead. But this time the smoke, instead of hiding him, is leading him deeper in.
Helen, who was Hele,
the druid says,
was none other than Persephone, the goddess of death and resurrection. It is she this whole land belonged to. It is her door atop this hill.
Stee lets out a sigh, looks at his watch.
In Erin of old she was Bridget, the exalted one, the fiery arrow. In Wales she was the ninefold muse Ceridwen. She is Astaroth, Venus, Hecate, and 1,000 others. She is the goddess who underlies all things, the supreme object of desire whom no man may resist, and no man may possess without being destroyed. Who ruled us all before her throne was stolen from her.
And suddenly Carl knows why Dead Boy brought him here. He is going to take Carl back with him, through the door. He wants to scream. He wants to get up and run. But there is a spell on him, making him weigh 1,000,000 tons. It's the hill, already pulling him into it. It's the hands in the fire, holding him down. Soon he will hear the door open. Then the shadows will come.
Stolen by the church,
the druid says.
By little priests in cells, scribbling out their Bibles, loving only gold and power. Thieves and paedophiles who presided over perversion. But she will be avenged. She will burn them all in her holy fire.
Stee jumps to his feet.
I'm freezing me hole off listening to this shite,
he shouts.
See you in the car.
He turns to go back down the hill. But now the little man gets up too. He puts his hand in his jacket. Then Barry slumps forward. After a moment, gently but swiftly, the tips of his hair catch on the bonfire and light into little flames, like birthday candles. He lets out a loud snore. Everybody starts laughing, even Stee, even the little cross-eyed man.
I think someone's had his fill,
the druid says.
Can't say I fucking blame him,
Dino says.
This weed is fucking lethal.
It's not weed, lad.
The druid laughs a big, chesty laugh.
It's heroin.
He laughs some more, and they all do too, laughing and laughing. Everyone is laughing. But Carl feels so, so sad. And then the screaming starts.
I'm just wondering if it's going to be entirely safe.
Jeekers in the wings.
I don't imagine anyone will get hurt,
Ruprecht says.
Though there may be some structural damage.
Oh my God!
Jeekers whimpers to himself. But it's too late. Titch is already introducing them. And now they are walking out onto the stage. The lights are so bright and so hot. Yet even through them, it seems he can feel the icy gaze of his parents. The avid gleam of their eyes as they wait to grade him out of 10 in this new field of endeavour. And although he cannot see them, and in spite of what he is about to do, he works up a watery smile and directs it into the great darkness. 2 days ago, Jeekers was eating lunch in the yard on his own, just as he does every day, when Ruprecht sat down beside him and told him he wanted to get the quartet back together. Jeekers was surprised to hear this, after everything that had happened. But then Ruprecht explained why. He wanted to use the quartet to get a message to Skippy.
I know it sounds unorthodox, but the fact is that there's a sound scientific principle behind it.
Here he reeled off a list of 19th century names who had apparently tried a similar thing.
Where they went wrong,
he said,
was in thinking of us, our four-dimensional space-time, as here, and the other dimensions as there, which meant they needed some kind of magical substance to bridge the gap in between. But in fact, you don't need any such substance. Or rather, according to M-theory, ordinary matter is also itself the magical substance.
He paused here, looking at Jeekers with eyes that blazed like Catherine wheels.
Strings! If they ripple one way, they make stuff. And if they ripple another way, they make light or nuclear energy or gravity. But in each case, they perform these ripples in 11 dimensions. Each string is like a chorus line with a stage curtain falling down the middle of it, so that one part is in our world and the other is in the higher dimensions. The same string that makes up one quark of one atom of the handle of your tennis racket could at the same moment be revolving in an entirely other universe. So, if every string goes beyond the veil, might it not be possible to somehow pass a message along the string from our side so it reaches the other side?
Like two tin cans tied together,
Jeekers said.
Exactly! Once you see it, the concept is quite simple. It merely becomes a question of how, and that's where the quartet comes in. In Lodge's book,
he explained,
the soldiers in Summerland, which was what they called the other world, reported that they could hear certain musical performances from the Albert Hall. What they were hearing were radio broadcasts. Evidently, certain combinations of sonic architecture and radio frequency have this amphibious quality that enables them to travel over to the higher dimensions. My theory is that some kind of sympathetic resonance must be involved. The tricky thing, then, is to find these amphibious frequencies. In the past, they used human mediums, who sniffed them out by a process of intuition. However, with a simple recalibration of the Van Doren wave oscillator, we can alleviate all need for a medium by translating our sonic message into every possible frequency, one of which has, of necessity, to be the one audible to the dead.
Listening to him elaborate on his plan, Jeekers recognized that Ruprecht had finally lost the plot. His experiments had always been a little zany for Jeekers' taste. Still, In the past, he could appreciate that they did have some exhilarating, if fleeting, points of correspondence with reality. This, though, this was delusion, nothing more. So why had he said yes? It's not that he hasn't felt sorry for Ruprecht over these last few weeks. And of course he feels terrible about what happened to Skippy. But when he thinks of how much trouble they're going to get into, and right in front of their parents, it's all right for Dennis and Jeff. They don't have academic records to protect. But Cheekers is putting his whole future in jeopardy. Why?